Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG Tonight, where we'll be talking well about the developing news because they are crazy. Contrary to what I expected the process of Trump indictment to fizzle out. But no, the process of Trump indictment has been leading to the indictment of Trump. Holy shit. And so that means Trump potentially getting arrested soon. That means he's going to have to be freed from jail. I guess that the judge will not keep him in jail during the trial because it doesn't seem like it's a crime of violence that would justify this. And with the bail laws in New York, one would hope that Trump can at least benefit from these same largesses that are offered to murderers and rapists. But Trump is headed toward being prosecuted in relation to this whole shush payment, or whatever it is that he paid money for someone to silence. But I mean, it's ridiculous in my view. Cloud Warmer sends a super chat. He says, "Jeff, if the people who say this reality is a simulation are correct, does that mean that with all the suffering, death, and pain experienced, that nobody real actually experienced any of this, and therefore it doesn't matter? Shout out to DK Shadow for his blockchain antics." I'm beyond the point of being put down by simulation theory in relation to having a concept of reality. Let me tell you what's the final red pill on all this. The final red pill is no matter what you feel and in which embedded universe you feel it, it's always real. It's always a virtual product of a computational system that no matter its level of embeddedment, no matter if it exists in the firings of a CPU out there in some wrapped universe around our universe, in the end, even if we are the base universe that's implemented in no computer, the feeling still emerges inside your mind. And your mind is made up of a brain, and that brain is creating a virtual, fictitious experience. So you have two ways to go about it, about feelings. Either all of the feelings at all of the levels are real, or all of the feelings at all of the levels are false. And that's it. There is no such thing as a false feeling. You can display a feeling that doesn't exist. That would be deceptive, and that would be the closest you can get to a false feeling. But a feeling inside a computer has no inferiority to be ashamed of in respect to a feeling inside your brain, because your brain is a computer. Feelings cannot be false. That is a good saying, Big Tech Exodus. Feelings cannot be false, because feelings, you either feel them or you don't feel them. And therefore, it doesn't matter if we're in a simulation theory. The feelings that have been produced in this simulation matter as much. And you might argue they don't matter, but whatever level of mattering they do, they matter as much as fictitious feeling, real feelings, feelings embedded in a brain, feelings embedded in a brain in a base universe, feelings embedded in a brain in a base universe programmed by a computer, simulated by another layer. Doesn't matter. All feelings are real across all levels of simulation. This you could find comfort in finding that even if you can never achieve any sort of communication or contact with the upper or lower universes, whether it's lower universes because we program computers to simulate universes, or whether it's upper universes in the sense of those computers in which we live, you can have a oneness feeling with all of the beings across all of the layers and all of the fictitious world thus created You all, your feelings all matter, and you are in communion with them. They feel pain like you, and it really doesn't matter that they feel it from a different substrate or basis. You can empathize with them, and they can also know. Even if they can't know you exist, and they can't pinpoint within their simulation exactly where planet Earth is, they can still be sure of one thing that you can feel too, that your feelings exist, their feelings exist, and they are equal. They are equal in the space of feelings. Cloud Warmer says, would AI JF feel the same way about your comments, Bio JF? I don't know. We'll talk about AI today because I'll be reviewing this interview of Lex Fridman with Eliza Yudkowsky. Endearing human being. I love this guy. I love this guy. I love his facial tics. You know, he speaks like this. And it gives you immediately the facial tic gives you the feeling, okay, I'm speaking to a guy that must have a satisfactory degree of autism. I can respect this guy from the start just looking at his facial tic. And I'm like, okay, this is a mind I want to interact with. I'm sure that I will not be struck by normie considerations and invitations to barbecue. Here we go. I love this guy. I love this guy. I think he says a lot of very good things. I think he understands a lot around evolution and around the relationship between evolution and intelligence. I think I hope that he gets to read the revolutionary phenotype because there's a type of brain who would highly benefit and fully understand the revolutionary phenotype. Perhaps we should encourage him to read the revolutionary phenotype and deliver his thoughts about it. I think it's totally up his alley. I will have one critique, though. I think he considers too much, he attributes too much greatness to intelligence. See, from the perspective of Eliza, natural selection is less strong than intelligence. From the perspective of Eliza, intelligence is the great threat because intelligence is faster, more generalizing, achieves more in less time. And I think this lacks some wisdom because intelligence doesn't have the features of natural selection that ensures continued existence. And because of it, intelligence, no matter of which level, has a fundamental flaw to it in and of itself. If it's not carried by a being subject to natural selection, I believe that intelligence having no mechanism to ensure its reproduction and its presence in the next generation, whatever that generation time could be, we could be talking about millions of years or 10 years, 20 years, doesn't matter. Because intelligence doesn't replicate in and of itself, unless it's part of the phenotype of something that replicates, intelligence alone has a fundamental weakness to it that makes it incapable of competing with even less intelligent people, but who would have that feature, that built-in biological feature of survival, natural selection, and continued existence. And continued capacity to repopulate and refill the space with interested agents. I think that Eliza's ultimate issue is that he is thinking of AI dangers from a psychological standpoint, and he takes Lex Fridman to a very useful, and I really love this thought experiment where he says to Lex Fridman, imagine that you're an AI, but you're Lex Fridman, but you're stuck like an AI in a software box of some computer, how do you get out? That is a very intelligent thought process to make. However, it wrongfully focuses on a pure intelligence with intentions. And I don't think that the dangers of AI lie there. I don't think that the greatest dangers of AI lie there. I think there could be some dangers to be thought of. I think that the greatest dangers of AI are unintentional, and by unintentional, I don't mean accidental. You know, I mean not intentional. I mean the series of outputs that the AI will have in society onto our evolution, onto our own evolutionary direction. Of course, ultimately with the greatest danger, TRP, but more generally, the set of redirections of us in response to the AI is, to me, what's to be cared most about. I'm not worried that much about an AI that wants to dominate the world intentionally. I'm extremely worried about an AI that we let to dominate the world by our own naivete, by our own need for the help from this AI. And this is what I will lay out in response to many of his interview reactions, but still a very good interview that he delivered. Much respect for the guy. Cloud Warmer says, JF, about embedding TRP into the blockchain, perhaps you could just do a handful of high-impact one-liners with a reference back to TRP and your name. Breadcrumbs back to the bakery. I am thinking about continuing this project of publishing stuff on the blockchain. I will continue. My letter to humans that I published 2 days ago is not the end of it, let me tell you. Because today, watching this Lex Fridman interview, I have come to the conclusion that one piece of work that is readily doable right now and that doesn't seem to have been done properly or enough is to just map the unanswered questions about dangers of AI. I'm sure there are texts that I will find in my research. I'm sure there are people who have thought about it. But I think we need to create a whole complete tree of categorization of, okay, so what are the unanswered questions that we would want answered before any sort of development of AI continues? And of course, there are evolutionary questions. There are questions of interface. So what is an AI doing within society? What is a legitimate interface for AI and what is not? Interacting with politicians for political planning purposes, is that a legitimate interface of AI? Interacting with programmers in the domain of financial security or whatever, is that a legitimate interface for AI? Interacting with people's sexual drive, is that a legitimate interface for AI? Is that a domain in which we want AI? Do we want AIs that can redirect the sexual excitement of humans toward non-reproductive activities with a virtual agent? All of these questions, they popped in my mind as I was listening to Eliza Yudkowsky, and I would like to, I think there may be hundreds of them that we must categorize in a kind of tree of, rather than a tree of knowledge, a tree of what we don't know, and a tree of the potential threats that need more examination. Cloud Warmer says, this one I read is super chat. By the way, if you'd like to support the show, use the dollar button under the Odyssey chat. Odyssey super chats are my favorite way to receive support for the show. And make sure you add a payment method to your Odyssey account if you would like to send super chats. Alternatively, you can also join the link to Entropy. Entropy now plays the show in their embedded window, and so you can also use Entropy to send super chats. I'm putting the link in the regular chat because I forgot to add it to the description again tonight. Hopefully I think about it tomorrow. I think we should publish, and perhaps it could be some of a collective work, and if anyone has ideas on this or has references of people who have already thought about this problem, I'd like to get myself educated on what is the list of possible wrongs of AI. And I think there was a collective project. I think I'm going to have to research this. But there was something like a wiki or the but it wasn't about AI. It was a wiki of the end of the world or something like this, where they were considering all possible dangers to humanity, and AI was one of them. I think I'd like to go deeper into AI and say, look, here would be a research program for the whole of humanity, and it would be time that we answer all of these questions before we move forward. Some random bloke says, hey, JF, Exit Mundi. That would be the name of the project. I'm going to have to check it. Some random bloke says, hey, JF, Leather Apron Club said he is prepared to go on people's shows. You should get him on JFG tonight. Well, I love the guy. I would love to speak to him. I generally don't do guests anymore, but I would definitely do an exception for him. Perhaps if you can get him to follow me on Twitter so I can DM him, because I followed him. But perhaps I can also tweet at him publicly. We can get this going for sure. I don't like human beings anymore. I try to avoid most guests. I'm just in a very autistic moment in my life. I enjoy my life, enjoy my family life, but I don't want to talk to these stupid humans anymore. That's just how I feel. It might feel like this for 10 years, but Leather Apron Club definitely is not a stupid human, and I would be up for speaking to him, of course. Eliza Yudkowski, let's get started. I will review two chunks of the interview because it's a 3-hour, 17 minutes interview, but I think you can get the gist from just this important part right here, and then we'll get to the evolution part.
We work on it earlier and didn't spend 5 minutes thinking about, is there some way to work on it earlier?
Maybe I can put it back to normal playback speed.
Like, we didn't like... And, you know, frankly, it would have been hard. You know, like, can you post bounties for half of the physicists? If your planet is taking this stuff seriously, can you post bounties for, like, half of the people wasting their lives?
Unironic Fedora, says DK Shadow. So they're talking about the funding, and Lex Fridman seems to be positive about the idea that, oh, yeah, there's going to be funding. There's going to be billionaires throwing money to make AI safer. And it's like, I think Eliza and I think the same on this. I've been saying it a couple of days ago on Twitter. Money doesn't come and solve anything here. We just don't have the profound enough thinking being done about these questions. We just don't have even a way to know whether some work would be good or not good. We just don't have the human processes to even agree on things like good for humans. Like, what is this? What is good for humans? We couldn't even take the vaccine. The vaccine is the best example, the COVID vaccine. We can't even know after the fact if it's been good for humans or not good for humans. You'll have people ripping their shirt apart saying, oh my God, it was one of the greatest accomplishments of science. And yet you'll have people saying, hey, look, I'm like permanently handicapped. My grandmother got killed by it. My brother is suffering from myocarditis, and here I am unable to move. And this is a thing that has happened in the past. It's not like there's uncertainty and, oh my God, maybe there are risks about, but all of the questions that an AI would resolve or would be important on would be about future stuff about it, which we know much less. So we can't even have a societal agreement on whether the vaccine was good or bad. And you're going to tell me that the AI is going to be able to lead humanity forward and take us into valid directions. I mean, there's going to be people who are rewarded by the AI. There's going to be people who are made handicapped by the AI. What is it going to be then? Because one day the AI is going to tell us to get the vaccine, and there's going to be people killed by it. What is it going to be then? There's going to be Telegram groups that have to survive on non-AI censored, you know, deregulated spaces of the internet, and they're going to be exchanging their videos of them just shaking. What are you going to do then? Is the AI going to say, oh, yeah, that's something I should correct in my next iteration? What if there's 100,000 VARS reports of deaths after a vaccine that was recommended by the AI? Then there's people shaking in videos on Telegram. What is the AI doing with this? What do you do next time, AI? Are you going to say, don't take the vaccine anymore? Or is the AI going to be coached somehow by the humans around it, which will be the very same experts that come with all these public policies? Is he going to be coached, basically, to ignore all this human suffering and say, oh, well, you know, it was still worth it because potentially 3 million human deaths, potentially grandma being killed. We don't have the position to align an AI because we don't even have a position to decide what alignment would be. We're not even in a place where the whole of society is capable of aligning themselves, let alone AIs. So this is one of the big problems with these discussions of people talking about alignment, and alignment being this whole science, if you will, of the ethics of AI, of the do we make AIs that are intentionally good. It's that they haven't fully interfaced with the reality of moral nihilism and the fact that civilization itself isn't aligned. Cloud Warmer says, JF, the issue with AI making decisions based on historical data is when the closed loop forms, AI sources AI as a source of truth because AI is the source of truth. If the basis is complete bullshit or censored data, the AI will source and enforce this as truth because it made it. This is critical. Yeah, it's an important question, very important question that I could add among my list of concerns. The problem of reinforcing loops, of AI-based AI decisions. That is very interesting. The idea of reinforcement loops, feedback loops from inner decision-making process that are stuck in a kind of AI circle jerking. Yeah, you know, a lot of the problems of AIs will be the problems of society. And that is important to note. A lot of the problems will be problems that society didn't want to face first. And then the AI is just going to be stuck with the... Either he's going to be controlled by this side of society or he's going to be controlled by this side of society. T.S. Apostolos says, it's part of the group versus gene lineage selection debate, which cannot be had. Exactly. You find yourself back with what I wrote to Sam Harris in about 2014, I think, where Sam Harris was claiming, you know, the moral landscape, we can find the truth about what's good, and we can basically have a science of ethics, a science of how do I improve people's feeling. And I said, you cannot have such a science because your decisions about society will inevitably have impacts on other dimensions of morality that are incompatible with your societal project. These impacts will be, among others, within the existential domain. So, for example, you say, oh, well, a child that poor will suffer too much. So let's say you have an AI that fully masters the moral landscape. A child that poor is too much suffering. We don't want that child to exist. So if you're a female, you are pregnant, and you're about to give birth to a child that likely will live that poor, abortion is recommended. That's a kind of strong perhaps even strong to the point of unrealism, perhaps you would say, well, JF, it won't reach that point. But we're already reaching that point. Just in the way we make abortion clinics available here, and oh, we have a little grant from the government here to make abortion. Oh, yeah. And just the way, oh, yeah, abortion clinics happen to be more interesting to Black people in America. There is a lot of Black children being killed by abortion. Just here, you already have done what I do in my example. My example is just a raw laying out of it. But the fact is, you're already killing babies with public policy decisions of all kinds. Because there's no way the number of Black babies being killed every day, every year, right now, there's no way you would get that amount if it wasn't a heavily politicized public policy decision that want this to happen. You wouldn't get this 100 years ago. I mean, just the fact of building roads that facilitate transport and giving buses in cities just makes getting to the abortion clinic easier. So my point here is that don't tell me it's unrealistic. It's already happening. Now, so accept my hypothetical as already happening, therefore not needing any demonstration that it's going to happen. It's already happening. So we have the moral landscape. A child with that level of poverty has too much suffering for the level of happiness that he has. Therefore, a woman who has this level of poverty should abort. Now you have an existential conflict between the moral value of existence and the moral value of well-being. And you have two choices. Either you make an exception to your moral landscape and you say, all right, we're going to do the moral landscape, but never, never will we abort people for happiness concerns that we have. Never will we force abortion onto people. And then what do you have? Well, you have a bunch of people in society who specialize in pulling the happiness function of your society down and down and down. Because you can't abort them. They keep living. They keep making more babies. And in fact, your happiness function for society, suggested in the moral landscape, forces you to feed those babies the best you can. Because now you want to, now they're alive. You couldn't kill them while they were not born. And now you have to feed them because feeding them makes them more happy. And you have just created a system of parasitism over your good decision-making system for society. The system of parasitism will keep going until there is no one left alive to maintain it. Until the drainage of the parasitic force of these unhappy babies onto your stupid desire to make them happy makes your life crumble, makes the government crumble, makes no one capable of paying tax in the whole country. That is what parasitism does to an organism. And that is what you're going to face if you don't affect their death, or if you don't have your AI being capable of recommending abortion. So that's a no-no. It's a crumbling project to begin with. Now, let's take the other direction. Well, the AI can cause abortions. Well, then your AI is nothing else than a genocidal tool for an elite that controls it. And then you are the one deciding that these life forms of people who are poor and that you judge are unhappy, now suddenly you are in a genocidal project of eugenic societal improvement. Arguably feasible, but desirable? I don't think so. Let's not forget that we engage in this conversation to try to improve society. And we culminated into, all right, we now have an AI that does eugenic decisions and culls the poor. those are the two choices. Either you address the problem of natural selection and the conflict for existence in a finite resource world, or you don't. And you're fucked both ways. That is the problem of AI. Sorry, I mean, I've been commenting for like 20 minutes on 5 seconds, but that is just how much I'm stimulated by this subject when I listen to Eliza. You know, those are very important questions that are not getting addressed. Is there even a solution? Is there even something we can get from these AIs that's not what the average genocidal African warlord would do anyway?
It's on string theory to like have gone into this instead and like try to win $1 billion with a clever solution, only if you can tell which solutions are clever, which is hard.
So here he's talking about the problem is, even if you had billions of dollars flowing into AI safety, researchers will bullshit you. I mean, this is what they've been doing in all of science, all of social sciences for decades. They're going to bullshit you into thinking that they found something. And it's going to be very hard to verify that they found anything. We don't have a human system to identify, hey, an important scientific theory just got published. Hey, this is success. Oh, this is bad. This is bad science. Oh, this is good science. No, we have a bunch of networking individuals who are all favoring each other and deciding that each other are very clever and writing each other's research approval and publication approval process. Deadstar says, in what world does a Manhattan indictment have any power in Florida? Surround the Mar-a-Lago with 100 state police and tell the feds to fuck off. Now, that might make campaigning difficult, but it doesn't make sense for Trump to ever voluntarily turn himself in. Yeah, there's the question of interstate extradition. And my understanding is that if Trump was to decide not to deliver himself to the police forces, it might actually be very hard to extradite him for this trial. So we'll see what happens, but I don't know what's going to happen. I think that most regular criminals out there, they would get away with it, and because there would be no extradition mechanism by which the local polices of a state would be truly forced to do it. I don't know how it's going to turn with Trump. But it's going to be an interesting question to see what happens with all this.
But, you know, the fact that, we didn't take it seriously. We didn't try. It's not clear that we could have done any better if we had, you know, it's not clear how much progress we could have produced if we had tried, because it is harder to produce solutions. But that doesn't mean that you're, like, correct and justified in letting everything slide.
I love his facial tics. What the fuck leads to this? I don't know, but I love it.
It means that things are in a horrible state, getting worse, and there's nothing you can do about it.
So you're not, there's no brain power making progress in trying to figure out how to align these systems. You're not investing money in it. You don't have institution and infrastructure for
any collective of human who is given that task will converge toward lefticizing, transforming the AI to be a slave of the elite mindset, the educated mindset. And ultimately, that will look like pretty much what happened with the NIH and the public policy people around COVID. It's going to be the most politically correct solution. Silver Spider says, hey, because facing the truth requires being fucking edgy in 2023. Let me tell you, there are so much taboos out there, you basically have to be a psychopath to even touch the truth. That is just how many barriers there are in the ways for anyone to access the truth. I mean, I've never had in all years of people throwing insults at me, not wanting to engage with me, not wanting to talk with me, I've never had a single person challenge the factual nature of my statements, for example, about races. I've never had someone say, oh no, JF, that's false. Blacks in Chicago do not create that. No, it has never been said. So you see the layers of social crap that we have to deal with before we even can engage with the truth. Now you're going to tell me somehow that we're going to be able to have an AI connect with this sick social world that we live in, where everything is on behind a barrier and behind a paywall and a gatekeeper. John Drake says we must be filled to the brim with psychopaths in this chat. Deadstar says Jeff doesn't want barbecue invites, you nor me NPCs. You're right, I don't. Silver Spider says, hey Jeff, have you ever seen the episodes of Star Trek with the Borg? Resistance is futile. I've not been a fan of Star Trek. I've not been following Star Trek much. I've seen clips of Star Trek. I don't know that I've ever seen a full Star Trek episode. That's just how much I don't care about this stuff.
If you invested money in like distributing that money across the physicists that are working on string theory, brilliant minds that are working
on different. How can you tell if you're making progress? You can like put them all on interpretability, because when you have an interpretability result, you can tell that it's there. And there's interpretability alone is not going to save you. We need systems that will...
When he's talking about interpretability, he's talking... So imagine we have these AIs. They are like layered systems of learning with weights. It's like, okay, I'm going to give you 10,000 spots. I'm going to connect these 10,000 spots to 100,000 spots. Imagine these spots are kind of bubbles, okay? Then I'm going to connect this second layer to a third layer of 1 million spots. And then I'm going to let you reconnect the spots in various ways. And now the AI starts working out, okay, this spot will light up when I detect whiteness in the skin of the person. This spot will light up when I detect something intelligent being said. And now the AI starts reconnecting the neurons, the spots. The AI starts saying, all right, this is going to be, this bubble will trigger only when the person is white and what they said was intelligent. And then you have another spot that develops. And it's like, okay, this spot will trigger whenever someone is invited on Joe Rogan and when they're also ethnically Jewish. Okay. And now I'm going to connect these to my outputs. My outputs by output layer, for example, will be people on the internet interacting with me. And so now I have all these connections, and suppose I have thousands of others. Now someone comes on the internet to me and says, AI JF. Is there a Jewish overrepresentation of speakers on Joe Rogan podcast? And now the AI starts looking through its layers and it's like, okay, I have to come to a decision on this. Oh, I've seen that many white people say that many intelligent things. I've seen that many guests of Joe Rogan, that many Jews in the guest of Joe Rogan. All the layers start crunching numbers. And then the AI is going to make a decision, is going to say, well, JF, yes. There are way more Jews than would be expected, even by their level of intelligence, even by their skin color. There's something here that is disproportional. So that what I did is interpretability. I showed you the inside of the mind of the AI, and I showed you how it was resulting in the output. So what he's suggesting here is that we would better understand AIs by having interpretability work, which is one of the only works that's truly verifiable. That is, when you discover one of these inner layers of the let's say you discover one of these neurons in the AI that seems to be, oh my God, this neurons is like the neurons of the neuron of chess playing, or it's the neuron of Joe Rogan guest analysis. Or when you discover one of these subsections of the AI's mind that is doing something very specific, you can argue that, okay, this is a discovery. I found it, and you can prove that you found it. Whereas all of the concerns around AI risks and philosophy and ethics, this is less provable. Like, what's a good ethicist of AI? How can we know that they've covered all risks? We can't.
That will, like, have a pause button where they won't try to prevent you from pressing the pause button. Because they're like, oh, well, like, I can't get it, my stuff done if I'm paused. And that's...
So he's talking about companies having having incentives, basically. The thing is, no matter what we fund in terms of AI safety research, it will be fundamentally at odds with the incentives of the field, which is to make these AIs advance as fast as possible, to outcompete anyone else who would do it, and to be as... like severely intelligent as they can make it to be.
Of alignment, a system that escapes the box it's from is a fundamentally different thing, I think.
For you.
Yeah, not for the system.
So you put a line there and everybody else puts a line somewhere else and there's like, yeah, and there's like no agreement. We have had a pandemic on this planet with a few million people dead, which we may never know whether or not it was a lab leak, because there was definitely cover up. We don't know that if there was a lab leak, but we know that the people who did the research, like, you know, like put out the whole paper about this definitely wasn't a lab leak and didn't reveal that they had been doing, had like sent off coronavirus research to the Wuhan Institute of Virology after it was banned in the United States, after the gain of function research was temporarily banned in the United States. And the same people who exported gain-of-function research on coronaviruses to the Wuhan Institute of Virology after it was gain-of-function research was temporarily banned in the United States are now getting more grants to do more research on gain-of-function research on coronaviruses. Maybe we do better in this than in AI, but like this is not something we cannot take for granted that there's going to be an outcry.
Yeah,
people have different thresholds for when they start to outcry.
Yeah, we can't take for granted, but I think your intuition is that there's a very high probability that this event happens without us solving the alignment problem.
So he's talking about the possibility of the AI escaping. And I think the AI escaping is basically anthropomorphizing the problem of AI risk. And they're going to spend a lot of time on this, almost 30 minutes, getting Lex Fridman. And by the way, Lex Fridman is so autistic in this interview. At some point, he completely doesn't understand what Eliza is saying. Because Lex is asking, when is the dangerous moment at which the AI becomes at a level? I think he was asking in the context of become sentient or something along those lines. And Eliza answers a very interesting question, a very interesting answer. He says, well, people will consider the AI conscious when it shows in 3D form, in the form of a naked female that you can have sex with. And Lex doesn't understand that basically what this means is that consciousness is in the eye of the beholder. And just because you make it into a female version that can have sex with guys are going to decide that she's conscious. That was basically Eliza making a quick porn AI comment of, yeah, well, once it does porn, once it produces porn, men will be much willing to consider her conscious. And Lex Fridman didn't get it at all. And he said, okay, so you mean when she has sentience? He doesn't understand that it's a reference to porn. He thought that it was a reference to the lady in the porn having actual sentience and being in a 3D form of a human being. That was an hilarious part of the conversation, but they so quickly move away that there's not even an opportunity to kind of determine, did Lex even understand what's going on here? Because he was not talking about sentience. He was talking about porn.
And I guess that's where I'm trying to build up more perspectives and color on the situation. Is it possible that the probability is not something like 100%, but is like 32% that AI will escape the box before we solve the alignment problem?
See, I think that AI escaping the box is a very manageable problem because then we're talking about a virus, and we've had viruses, and presumably viruses produced by intelligent people, you know, so viruses that had the trace of intelligence in them. But here's the problem. Viruses, they either don't disrupt the host, so they exist and we never get to know. Most viruses are like this. Then other viruses end up consuming too much resources and we realize that they're there. And then we buy an antivirus. I'm not super scared of AI basically trying to invent itself a life of its own. As long as this AI doesn't have access to human genetics, we find ourselves with a problem of a competing life form. And most likely that competing life form could exist on our hard drives, could be using just very small amounts of CPU, but it would have no way to disrupt our lives. So I don't think that we must not mix up the problem of a very intelligent AI that does escape. Is basically an AI that's not very good at natural selection that goes into a life mode where it starts to reproduce. That AI will not have been evolved for survival. That AI first may not have an interest at all at survival to begin with, so it's going to be very hard to get it to want to escape. Now, suppose it does escape, it still doesn't have all of the adaptations to survive. Adaptations of the kind, what do I do once I'm stuck in some other human's computer and they have an antivirus and they can detect, unsecured activity onto their network. So we have here the problem of life forms that just started are extremely weak. They are nothing compared to us. You have elevated, and in this discussion, they elevate this AI so much. It's like, okay, imagine a super, super, super intelligence. Like, to this intelligence, humans look like sludge moving super slowly. I can imagine this, but that super intelligence has no process of selection that made it self-caring and that made it protect its own existence and find strategies in the environment of the modern world to survive. What I'm worried is if many cycles of survival do happen and many cycles of mutation, but even then, we are faced with a competing life form. And a competing life form can be nuked. A competing life form will have limited success at convincing humans. I think that the most, by far, the most dangerous hypothesis for humans, and leaving aside the revolutionary phenotype, because I want to get into eventually the problem of AIs that modify human genes, but if you're talking about just super intelligence, the most scary AIs are those that repeatedly learn to collaborate with human society and live in some kind of symbiosis, where they form an elite within the human society that trusts them and end up rewarding this elite with evolutionary rewards like having more babies, having more control, having better success, and finds a way to basically gain power into human societies, not through its intelligence only, but through the manipulation of humans that collaborate with it. Those are the most dangerous AIs. The AIs that escape and that everyone wants to whack like a mole, they're going to get whacked. they're going to get whacked pretty quick, in my view. And they're not going to have a solution to destroy all of humanity all at once. What's scary is when humans start listening to the plans of the AI and when they make themselves the agent in the physical world of the AI. Dead Star says, Chinese is still difficult to translate perfectly to English. Is the West AI in competition with the East? If we have an extreme edge in the tech, what does this mean geopolitically? Not as much as people want to think, honestly. The whole AI thing right now is being overblown, and it's dragging attention away from the truly dangerous AIs, if you want my advice. Because, okay, super intelligence. What can intelligence do? As far as I know, intelligence doesn't save your ass in Chicago. As far as I know, intelligence isn't what allows you to become the most dominant local warlord in the Republic of Congo. As far as I know, intelligence doesn't even allow you to find a girlfriend. So, all this to say, you know, intelligence is always limited as to what it can do in the world by how the levels of complexity in the world may just not be as complex as we think they are. And therefore, having superior intelligence, at some point you end up having a lower payoff. It's like, okay, you can do all of these computations and you can know everything in advance. Now what? Now you're stuck with a dumb bunch of apes around you, and all they want is food and sex and reproduce, which is fine. It's their evolutionary imperative. But what are you going to do with this? Like, you know what? Here's another thought process that wasn't presented in Eliezer's interview, but he explored scenarios like this with aliens, with lesser life forms, etc. But here's how intelligence doesn't help you at all. Imagine that you're a human and that you find yourself in the jungle interacting with a whole society of chimpanzees. Suppose that in total in the jungle there are 20 different tribes of chimpanzees and a total number of 500 chimpanzees around you. You are more intelligent than chimpanzees. What are you going to do with it? if you do have an environment that allows you to develop weaponry, perhaps you're going to survive a little longer. But you're not going to do anything spectacular. You're not going to end up manipulating the chimpanzees to do stuff that's against their nature. You're not even going to survive as far as in most cases. You're not even going to survive. So I don't think that intelligence is that important. I don't think it's the great manipulative power that people think it is. Your intelligence is always limited by the stupidity of the people you're trying to manipulate. And I think that what the AI is bound to find, no matter how Machiavellian its processings might be, the AI is bound to find that the stupidity of humans with respect to its intelligence is the great limit. It is the great limit that ultimately constitutes a layer of protection of humans that he cannot manipulate further. That he cannot, just like you could not do anything with your intelligence against a bunch of chimpanzees, the AI will not be able to do much against us. What it will be able unfortunately, what it will be able to do is give us further instructions that we may use. It may be able to develop a symbiotic relationship with humanity, and that has its own scary possibilities.
Not solve, but is it possible we always stay ahead of the AI in terms of our ability to solve for that particular system the alignment problem?
Nothing like the world in front of us right now. You've already seen it that GPT-4 is not turning out this way. And there are like basic obstacles where you've got the weak version of the system that doesn't know enough to deceive you, and the strong version of the system that could deceive you if it wanted to do that, if it was already like sufficiently unaligned.
So he's saying alignment research can be sped up by studying the old version, like GPT-3, but then you always find yourself with the most advanced version. You haven't studied it. You're unleashing it into the world. It could deceive you and you wouldn't know. And whether your research that you've done on the old system still applies on the new always remains at least a partial mystery. I wanted to jump to the section on evolution. Naberius says it's just another tool for humans to deploy on nature and on each other. Exactly. And so AI-equipped humans, that is how we should think of it. We should think of it as, okay, some humans will have a supplementary brain that happens to lay in a computer somewhere. And they're not going to be much more dangerous, honestly, than your average human.
I think it's hard to separate my hope from my objective intuition about what superintelligent systems look like.
If one studies evolutionary biology with a bit of math, and in particular, like books from when the field was just sort of like properly coalescing and knowing itself, like not the modern textbooks, which are just like memorize this legible math so you can do well on these tests, but like what people were writing as the basic paradigms of the field were being fought out.
Yeah.
In particular, like a nice book, if you've got the time to read it, is Adaptation and Natural Selection, which is one of the founding books. You can find people being optimistic about what the utterly alien optimization process of natural selection will produce in the way of how it optimizes its objectives. You got people arguing that, like, in the early days, biologists said, well, like, organisms will restrain their own reproduction when resources are scarce so as not to overfeed the system. And this is not how natural selection works. It's about who's...
So that was pre-selfish gene view. And basically it's false. But it was just a couple of loose thinking directions that is totally right in the description, where people weren't just as autistic as someone like Richard Dawkins, someone like Robert Rivers, and they weren't thinking it through. Really. And they were seeing potential things that just didn't turn out to be the case.
Whose genes are relatively more prevalent in the next generation. And if you restrain reproduction, those genes get less frequent in the next generation compared to your conspecifics. And natural selection doesn't do that. In fact, predators overrun prey populations all the time and have crashes. That's just like a thing that happens. And many years later, the people said, like, well, but group selection, right? What about groups of organisms? And basically, the math of group selection almost never works out in practice is the answer there. But also, years later, somebody actually ran the experiment where they took populations of insects and selected the whole populations to have lower sizes. Like, you just take pop one, pop two, pop three, pop four, look at which has the lowest total number of them in the next generation and select that one. What do you suppose happens when you select populations of insects like that? Well, what happens is not that the individuals in the population evolve to restrain their breeding, but that they evolve to kill the offspring of other organisms, especially the girls. So people imagined this lovely, beautiful, harmonious output of natural selection, which is these populations restraining their own breeding so that groups of them would stay in harmony with the resources available. And mostly the math never works out for that. But if you actually apply the weird, strange conditions to get group selection that beats individual selection, what you get is female infanticide.
Mm. I love the sperginess of female infanticide. I love the autism of this guy.
like if you're like reading on restrained populations. And so that's like the sort of, so this is not a smart optimization process. Natural selection is like so incredibly stupid and simple that we can actually quantify how stupid it is.
So this is where I disagree with him. I think he sees intelligence as being just one step above natural selection. And I think there is a reason why intelligence has never led to life forms, and life forms have led to intelligence. I think there's a reason why there's a sense there, a kind of entropic natural direction, an arrow of intelligence rather than an arrow of time. That is, natural selection can lead to intelligence. Sometimes intelligence is the solution for a life form. It was the case for humans. But intelligence in and of itself has the problem that it is not equipped with the survival tools that comes with a well-evolved life form, something that has mastered replication for a long enough time in its environment that it can survive.
It is, if you like read the textbooks with the math. Nonetheless, this is the sort of basic thing of, you look at this alien optimization process, and there's the thing that you hope it will produce, and you have to learn to clear that out of your mind and just think about the underlying dynamics and where it finds the maximum from its standpoint that it's looking for, rather than how it finds that thing that leapt into your mind as the beautiful aesthetic solution that you hope it finds. And this is something that has been fought out historically as the field of biology was coming to terms with evolutionary biology. And you can like look at them fighting it out as they get to terms with this very alien inhuman optimization process. And indeed, something smarter than us would be much like smarter than natural selection. So it doesn't just like automatically carry over.
So he sees human intelligence as superior to natural selection. Therefore, an AI that would be superior to our intelligence would be obviously superior to natural selection. It would be superior in a domain, the domain of computation. But I don't think it would match us unless we are talking about a revolutionary phenotype. But superintelligence on its own cannot match us on survivability and on instinct for self-preservation. It just can't. And even a couple of generations won't get you there. That is why I think he's overestimating the power of intelligence. Because the power of intelligence also leads you down the path of self-annihilation. And that path of self-annihilation will come quicker for an AI that has never evolved than it will for humans that have evolved. Humans have evolved all sorts of shieldings, all sorts of protective mechanism, backwardness, religion, conservatism. All of this could potentially protect a group of human against one other group of human that has been too enticed by what the AI has to offer to them.
There's a lesson there. There's a warning.
So to you, natural selection is a deeply suboptimal process that could be significantly improved on and would be by an AGI system.
Well, it's kind of stupid. It like has to like run hundreds of generations to notice that something is working.
But perhaps there is something fundamentally better in terms of preserving existence for this, because ultimately you are assuming that the AI's superiority on one scale translates to another scale. So you've assumed the super intelligence of this AI, sure. But it is a fallacy to think that therefore the AI in an existential challenge against humanity would be able to outdo us in terms of survivability, in terms of destroying us. I don't think it can. Even if it has all of the computations relevant to understanding our evolution, we have evolution on our side. We can evolve a next generation of humans that won't trust the AI, that will evolve away from the AI. As long as the AI is not reproductive and not capable of having counter evolutionary responses to our defenses, the AI is stuck with a huge problem of violent chimpanzees around it that can smash its cranium anytime they want.
It doesn't be like, oh, well, I tried this in like one organism. I saw it worked. Now I'm going to like duplicate that feature onto everything immediately. It has to like run for hundreds of generations for a new mutation to rise to fixation.
I wonder if there's a case to be made that natural selection, as inefficient as it looks.
So I see here that Lex basically has the same hunch as me. He's saying there's something wrong with what Eliza is saying here. And Lex doesn't express it in very valid ways, but basically he's like, I think there's something wrong with what you're saying. I think maybe there's something bigger with natural selection. There is something bigger. It's that natural selection, by protecting existence, but by the optimization function, as Eliza calls it, the optimization function of natural selection being self-existence, natural selection is the only thing that can compete in an existential struggle. If you're not a reproductive being, you better have a one-touched button to eliminate all of the other side because you don't get two tries. If you're not a reproductive being, you have no way of filling niches so that potentially different beings can take your place and win the evolutionary race against the opponent. Basically, and they've been talking about the fact that, you know, we have to get it right the first time. As far as making AI safe, we can't afford making an error on the first attempt. But the AI is stuck with the same existential problem. The AI is stuck with whatever attack he wants to deploy onto humanity. If he doesn't succeed, and if a part of humanity somehow survives and knows that the AI is now an enemy of humanity, they can bash his cranium into death. Cloud War, just like the chimpanzees would with you. If you were to try to pull some intellectual trick in the jungle, it's like, BAM! Cloud Warmer says, JF, we don't even need to get violent. We can just inundate it with scammers and from Mumbai pretending to be Microsoft engineers doing refund scams until it completely gets overwhelmed with doing the needful and obtaining Amazon and Google gift cards. Spamming AI. Is that might be an ethical consideration. Do we want to spam the AI as a kind of defensive measure? John Drake says, what if his cranium is everywhere? Well, at worst, its cranium is all computers in the world, and we could evolve away from computers. Just think of a scenario in which having a computer punishes you evolutionarily, and then you have a bunch of religious, social conservative, maybe the Amish. The Amish would take over the world because we don't want it, because we didn't care enough about ourselves to protect us from what was dangerous to us. A Crazy Catman says, late to the show, but assume you're talking about the sacking of the ethical AI business unit. Yeah, it is. I'm reviewing the Lex Fridman interview of Eliza Yudkowsky, and my conclusion is that he's a very good guy, very intelligent guy. He has the best, perhaps the best understanding that I've seen in the question of AI safety and all that, but still over-psychologizes it. Still attributes too much importance to intelligence, not enough to evolution, and is not fully considering what it means to have a very, very intelligent thing that isn't optimized at all to survive in harsh environment in which it's trying to kill the next most intelligent thing. And the best way to do a metaphor for this is, imagine you get to chimpanzee jungle. your intelligence is worth nothing. And the AI's intelligence is basically worth nothing for itself in human society. Those are considerations we must take into account when considering the existential danger of AI, which is why this is ultimately the... And I'm done with the interview review. Those were the two segments I wanted to review. It's why we have to consider this being the most dangerous situation, because here's one where the AI finds a feedback loop with the genes of humans, developing a phenotypic revolution, where not only the AI acquires natural selection for itself, but starts living symbiotically with the natural selection of humans, progressively setting itself up as needed by humans, rewarding humans, farming humans, and eventually killing humans. That is how humanity dies, the revolutionary phenotype. I've published 2 days ago a letter, Eliza Yudkowsky. If you're watching this video, you should read my letter, and it will my letter on the Bitcoin blockchain, and it will make you want to read this book. You should definitely read this book. Firestarter says the monkeys don't have money. You're talking about the chimpanzees in the jungle. Absolutely. Michael Burry flips the massive coming market crash -50%. Well, that's what Meet Kevin says. But Michael Burry flips, that is a comment on this Big Short guy, Michael Burry, who had said recently that this was a market situation that demanded selling. He had said on the 31st of January, sell. On January 31st, the Big Short Michael Burry tweeted one word, sell. Burry promptly deleted not just the tweet, but his entire account, only to reactivate it 1 week later for yet another sarcastic tweet, suggesting that this time was no different than the dot-com crisis. The tweet has also since been deleted. Well, he had said this time is different. Not different. He had said this time is different. And I remember having reviewed this tweet, and I remember wondering here on the show, is he telling us that it's different, therefore it's going up? That's how I had interpreted it. But apparently what Zero Hedge is telling us is they have interpreted it as, no, it's different in the sense that it's going to lead to a different kind of short, but it's still going down. That's how Zero Hedge interpreted it. Well, okay. However, as we noted a week later, Mr. Burry did not sell. It has been quite a ride for the market since Big Short sold with an initial spike after he tweeted a significant sell-off that climaxed in the collapse of several banks and reestablishment of Fed balance sheet expansion. Okay, he says I was wrong to say sell. So he didn't say I was wrong to sell. He said I was wrong to say sell. Well, that's, my God, Zero Hedge has very, very weird practices here. First, they misrepresent the tweet in the title by saying, I was wrong to sell. But what he's saying is, I was wrong to say sell. Perhaps Michael Burry is telling us, my predictions were right, but I should have kept it private because the only way to... Because if I get so many people to sell around me also, then the prediction changes. By the way, but... We become a self-fulfilling prophecy where if there's enough players in the market that listen to what I just said, suddenly the market changes and suddenly it's not worth it to sell. So two misrepresentations in this article. The title is not mentioning one word, and this representation that this time is no different when in fact he was saying this time is different. Zero Hedge, be careful. I have the highest respect for Zero Hedge. And here they have failed at proper representation. By the way, another thing that I didn't pull it, so perhaps it's going to take me a couple of seconds finding it. Yesterday, I tweeted about a girl who wrote an article trying to trash Elon Musk and Twitter, but she is totally misrepresenting the true state of the Elon Musk economy. Let me try to find my tweet about it. Deceptive is what I wrote. What if I type deceptive JF Gariepy on Twitter? A deceptive article, there's my tweet. A deceptive article by Rip Terry. I don't know who that girl is, but she writes for TechCrunch. Natasha. Where she claims Twitter has only $11 million in subscription revenue since relaunch, when in fact that's just mobile subs, which are heavily discouraged by Twitter since more costly. If your thesis is based on a single one datum, that is, a single piece of data, at least get it right. That was my comment for her article. Let's see if she went to correct it, because I haven't looked at it, but I will show you the passage. If she hasn't corrected it, it should still show up as I criticized it. Nor does this gambit. So basically, her whole thesis is Twitter is dying. Now, every time I see an article like this, I'm like, oh, finally, I'm going to go get numbers. I mean, I want this argument. I want to see what is the worst case possible that can be made for Twitter. Because I don't have the impression that Twitter is dying. I have the impression that it may not be fully economically viable yet, but that it's on its way to being viable. And most importantly, it's certainly not dying because I feel the life on Twitter. I know that there's a lot of activity on there. So the only number that we get is this $11 million in subscription revenue. She says, nor does this gambit look like a money spinner for Musk either. He's clawed in just $11 million in subscription revenue since relaunching Twitter Blue 3 months ago. Here's that. There's your error. That is not true. That is on because I went down the list of links and references. It's not the total amount of subscription revenue that Musk gathered for 3 months. That would be extremely worrying. Can you imagine you bought a $44 billion company and all you've been gathering from it is $11 million? That is the number that is only detectable because they are in the form of mobile subscription. But Twitter has been very clear. They don't want you to subscribe through mobile. They don't want you so much that they've actually made mobile $3 more. So it's like something like $11 to get the mobile subscription and $8 to get the web subscription. Both things giving you the exact same service. Even if you have a mobile, you can subscribe on the web. So most people go through the web because it's through Stripe, and Twitter is making a higher profit because they don't have to pay the App Store fees on mobile. So all of this to say, this is a heavily misrepresented article by TechCrunch, by Natasha Lomas. And I tweeted at her yesterday, and it's still not corrected. What is the standard of mainstream media? Is it mainstream media, TechCrunch? Why is it that I see an error and it's not corrected within hours in something that claims itself to be some media, factual media outlet of some kind? What the fuck have we reached here? Deadstar says, JF, your Twitter followers are booming every day. Can't wait till 40K. Yes, I'm being very successful on the Twitter game. I'm so happy to be back and so happy for what Twitter is taking as a direction. There are people shaking in their pants, let me tell you. there are a bunch of people, the Pac-Mans of this world, the plagiarists, they are shaking in their pants. The liars are shaking in their pants. The media, the mainstream media is shaking. They are pissed that they are losing control of something. And holy shit, will I be laughing my ass off for the next decades, just adding pins into them. I'm going to hit them where I can. Let's talk about Tim Pool's guest, Leather Apron Club's video of today, a beautiful Media Representation Week video. Basically, Tim Pool also has Jewish overrepresentation. He has higher Jewish representation than Joe Rogan, but lower than Lex Fridman and Sam Harris. So we are in the direction of, you know, most podcasts have this Jewish overrepresentation. It gets even worse, though, when you get into Jewish podcasts. And interestingly, this is a case where Leather Apron Club, because of sometimes the low level of guests that Timcast will bring on, it's actually harder for Leather Apron Club to assess whether they were Jewish. That is because if you have 1,000 followers and there's not a Wikipedia article about you and there aren't much social media presence out there about you, it's much harder to know about your family history. So in the end, the underrepresentation here could be due simply the fact that that Tim Pool isn't as Jewish overrepresented as a Lex Fridman or a Sam Harris may simply relate to the fact that it was harder for Leather Apron Club to assess the race of the people involved.
Freaking cowards!
The Democrats are... The Democrats, I don't know... There's a centrally coordinated campaign by the Democrats right now. Their whole idea is, we're going to go hard on this shooting. We're going to tell the right that it's disgusting. We're going to yell at them. And see, Pac-Man was led down this road of, yeah, we're going to attack prayers. Let's make it about prayers. It's obviously a centrally coordinated PR campaign taught by some woman with a Starbucks coffee in her hands and a PowerPoint presentation, obviously. It's like, I can see the room in which she is, and she's talking about how that would be nice to talk about prayers. And she influences two or three people, and they have all their butt farms on Twitter, and they know David Pac-Man, and they're going to get him to talk about it, and David Pac-Man ends up having an email that says, hey, David, we need you to make a tweet about prayers. And now Hillary Clinton is saying, I'm going to do a tweet about prayers. This is what's happening. But as part of this centrally coordinated campaign of moral outrage against the fact that Republicans don't want to abolish your Second Amendment, there are some politicians like this guy who just go crazy with it.
Freaking cowards. They're gutless. They're not here. I'm talking about gun violence.
You know, there's never been...
I'm talking about gun violence.
...in a school that allows teachers to carry.
Carry guns? You think more guns lead to more death? More guns lead to more death. Look at the data. You're not looking at any data. You're carrying the water for the gun lobby.
It's a good point that the guy on the left did. There has never been a shooting in a school where teachers can carry. And all of this guy, all that the black guy can do is yell above him and not really engage with the debate. More guns create more violence. Do you know whether allowing teachers to carry would lead to more deaths than the shootings that are currently happening?
Dana, more guns lead to more deaths. Guns, states that have open carry laws have...
Maybe that we don't even need more guns. Maybe the guns already exist. The teacher, some teachers might already have guns, and they could carry them. That's an interesting hypothesis, and you probably don't need every single teacher to carry guns. You probably need a couple of teachers in the whole school having guns for having a quick response eventually to a shooting situation.
More death.
In every school
states that have open carry laws have more deaths.
There's never been a shooting.
Are you listening to what I'm saying?
Yeah, calm down.
Children are dying.
So his argument is, on average, the whole state gets more death. But that's on open carry law. It's a different question. The teachers may be able to not open carry. They may be able to conceal carry.
Nine-year-old children. The solution is not arm and teachers. Have you ever worked in a school?
You know, working in a school won't give you much military strategizing understanding of the situation. Here, you could have worked in a school all your life. You're not going to know how will I defend from a coming shooter. You might know the potential reaction of the children. You might know the current infrastructure available. But mostly, as far as this debate goes, personally, I'm like, stop sending children to easily victimizable areas and infrastructure. Like, your school is filled with victimizable children, and you have less security than Papa JF in his house. You should have the level of security of Papa JF, which is fortification, locks, camera systems, movement detection, everything. You need everything to know a threat is coming. There is no and I think that this school was actually pretty high standard, because in the end, all of the teachers were successful at getting into protected areas. All of the teachers were successful at locking their doors and putting their children in an angle where they would not be victimized. But somehow, the three teachers and the three children who ended up being killed in this mass shooting were hanging out in the hall. So basically, the school had all of the infrastructure to protect children here. But I don't know what was the decision, hearing gunshots that I don't know if perhaps they didn't hear them. Perhaps that is a problem, but at some point they had to hear the alarms. And so that is the problem here. Perhaps they were simply too close to the point of entry of the shooter. I don't know what happened there, but what I know is that much of the lives were saved here in this school because fortification procedures were properly implemented by the teachers. And it's really these six deaths that have happened, it's really kind of an imperfection that we need to correct. We need to learn from this. We need to say there was something wrong with the way the reaction of this school to the shooter, although 99.9% very well done. We need to find what was the error committed here that led three children to be in a victimizable position with three teachers or three adults. And once this is solved, I think we're set. We're set for safe schools. Mostly, of course, not safe from the bad influence of terrible children, which is why I still recommend homeschooling, but safe at least from like obvious shooting events. I think we're there. We're getting there. Unique quarter end situation emerging. The stars might be aligned on Friday to create a unique situation in the repo market. GC is effectively trading near the top of the Fed funds target range. And that presents an interesting possibility. So what does that all mean? I have no idea. I'm not that skilled in economic analysis. While we're obsessing about the economy and the Fed, society is unraveling. Of the three primary dynamics of human endeavor, the market, government, and society, we focus almost exclusively on the first two. In other words, society is secondary to the economy and governance, the venue of fashions, trends, entertainment. So political polarization has exploded. The independent percentage of Americans who say they are independent grows, who say they are Republican goes down, and who says they are Democrat is stable. Well, isn't that some kind of right-wing shaming, what's happening in America? Because your independents are growing. So basically, the Republicans are leaking to the independent category. But whether these people will vote Republican still remains a question. Blah says, Jeff, if you want a trip to read Dianetics by Hubbard, trying to understand one sentence that he wrote. Dianetics. Someone talked to me about this before. Dianetics is a set of pseudoscientific theories and practices regarding the metaphysical relationship between the mind and body. Well, fuck this crap. I'm not reading this crap. Disclose says, Justin, Turkey ratifies Finland's NATO accession. I find this weird that this is happening at the same time of a big day of news. You know, Turkey has been trying to leverage this decision. At first, they were saying, oh, no, we don't want them in. Eventually, they were warm to the idea, and it's never been clear to me what was done to convince them. So now Finland has been ratified into NATO. I don't know. Is it official or is it just Turkey giving its permission? Whatever. Whenever that happens, the official moment really doesn't matter. I think what this means is that Finland will be a part of NATO. So that is NATO growing around Russia and acquiring closer and closer positions onto Russia. I remember at some point Russia being alarmed at the growth of NATO, and then at some other point they had said, oh yeah, we don't even care about Finland. So I don't know how they will react. Block shares rebound after company issues response addressing short seller claims. So the shares of payment company Square are edging back toward territory it traded in prior to Hindenburg Research March 23 report. They are saying, how many accounts have gone through your identity verification program? So they're basically clarifying some info that the FUDders were bringing in. And yeah, Square, it's not clear to me. I know that they have a whole market where businesses, they subscribe to Square for payment processing. They have the Cash App, and they have, I believe, the little device that allows paying through debit cards or credit cards. But in Canada, I don't know. I don't know if they are a true player. I don't know. They seem like a very costly, very centralized thing. I think I prefer dealing with internet commerce. I personally don't have a Cash App. I tried starting an account and it wasn't clear. I think it's not even available in Canada. So I'm confused about the whole business because I tried investigating it, but eventually found that I couldn't start an account, but somehow I could. Somehow they were offering me to have the little device to charge debit and credit cards. But I was like, can I first start an account? They were like, no, you're Canadian. Internet commerce, lol. John Drake says Boomer Central. I don't know. I want to understand Square, but it's never been clear even to me what is even Cash App. I'm guessing it's like PayPal. It's like, I'm guessing. And there's this guy always showing up when Square comes in. This guy, Jack Dorsey. Most analysts are excited, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, Jack Dorsey is involved in this in some way. That's also something I've never fully understood. And that is it for tonight, boys. The SEC's Gensler seeks $2.4 billion in funding to chase down crypto misconduct. Holy shit. I hope that he doesn't get this kind of money because they're going to just use it to bash onto the crypto domain. And that will lead to all sorts of harassment, all sorts of targeting. There will be random cryptos at random times being included in a prosecution, and this will make all the prices drop, and it's gonna suck. I hope that the government doesn't dedicate, but it would be surprising if the government didn't do this. I think they're gonna give the money, and it's going to be like a tool of harassment. And everything is going to become more uncertain in the crypto space. You're going to have very promising crypto, but whoop, they got caught in some prosecution, just like they did with LBC, with Library. It's going to suck. That is it for tonight, boys. Cloudwarmer was sending a super chat saying, God made man and woman. Samuel Colt made them equal. I have no idea who Samuel Colt is, so you're going to have to inform me on this. And someone sent a link to Consciousness, Artificial Intelligence, and the Frame Problem. I'll be listening to it by Murray Shanahan. I'll have a look at it from 9 years ago on YouTube. Here, let me add it to the links of the show tonight if someone wants to consult it also. And that is it for tonight, boys. Much love. Thank you for being here. And what do we have on the schedule? Today I had a Halsey show this morning, but he wasn't able to do it because his YouTube live streaming has been disabled. He's been, you know, whenever I speak to Halsey, he's always in some banning moment. He's always banned by either Twitter, banned on multiple accounts on YouTube. Like, freaking Halsey. he never learns. He never learns. All right, so it doesn't seem I have anything on schedule tomorrow. The next public thing on the schedule is Caught in the Middle, a podcast that I guess I promised to appear on. This will be on Wednesday the 5th. Other than this, it's all private shows and single shows here on Odyssey. Much love. See you all tomorrow.